Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
We're back, 12 after the hour. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, and we're glad you're here. Joan Pride is our guest. We're glad she's here, too. She's senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. Joan, welcome back to the show.
Hey there, Jim. Thanks. Good to be back.
It's good to have you back, as always.
I would hope so.
And I'm so glad you're here today to help us cover the page one of the Kiplinger letter.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
You're going to have to pay extra for this.
This is the lead story out of Kiplinger this week is about this the currency situation, the dollar, the value of the dollar against other currencies, and we're so happy to have our currency expert with us.
Oh, great.
Well, Joan, you're our currency expert. Aren't you happy about that?
If I'm your currency expert, you're in big trouble.
The dollar, Joan, as we all know, the dollar has been weakening.
Yes.
It's been weak. It's been down. It's not trading very well against other. Or I say trading very well. It's not very very close to being on par to many exchanges. For example, right now, what is it against the euro? Does your diagram show here? It doesn't. But for against the euro, for example, when I was in Rome, how long ago? 3 years ago. Or so, the dollar and the euro were pretty close to being on par.
Yes.
The euro, not the pound, ladies and gentlemen, the English pound, but the euro, which when we were in Italy, they were just starting to use it at that time in Italy, and it was in fact it was the dollar was a little bit weaker than the pound. I mean, than the euro, but the Italians were glad to take it for par. They would literally give you, even though it was like 97 cents to the to the euro, they would actually take it as if it were a full euro.
Oh right, yeah, absolutely.
Because they liked having the dollars.
Right, right.
And which, as it turns out now, it was a bad bet for them.
Yeah.
If they kept it for very long, because now it's like a dollar. It's like 1.6, isn't it? Something like
right.
that.
That's right.
I've forgotten. Maybe not. No, it's not that much, because I think it's 1.6 or 7 against the pound. It's 1.4, I think, against the euro.
Still, to me, that's amazing.
Yeah, now, interestingly enough, other countries, you know, there still are a couple of countries in Europe that aren't part of the euro. Denmark.
Well, and Great Britain being one of them, sure.
Exactly. And Denmark. And I didn't realize, I'd forgotten that they were one of them, but as you know, we're going to be going to Denmark pretty soon.
That's right.
And so I was checking as we checked out there some of the stuff that we got going on over there, they still use the krona.
Yes.
But anyway, the dollar is weakening. It has been weak. And it's still, though, Joan, you guys point this out, it's not at its lowest, is it? It's been weaker than this.
That's right. It has been weaker.
I'd forgotten about that.
See?
In the 90s.
Yeah.
Right. It was weaker. So let's talk about, you know, the average person listening, Joan, right now is saying, what the heck's that got to do with me and the price of eggs?
Well, and also, our lead says a lot of good things about the dollar being weak. And I think people say weak dollar, that doesn't sound good. That's got a weak means bad. But in this case, not necessarily. At least, you know, there are bad points to a weak dollar, but there's also bad points to a strong dollar. And, of course, it all revolves around imports and exports.
That's exactly right. Imports and exports and travel.
That's
because
right.
Because if you are a destination in the United States where Europeans or other people in other parts of the world want to come, then you're a good buy for them. You're a good value for them.
Right.
But if you and I are going across the pond to Europe, for example, then we're going to pay a premium.
Exactly.
Like I said, if it's one point, if a euro is 1.4, and 3 years ago it was on par at 1-to-1, then you got to pay 40% more for goods and services.
I think you're the currency expert now, not me.
So, Joan, But if you're an exporter, if you're a manufacturer especially, and if you're an exporter in the United States, and you're going to any, you know, to any, especially anywhere like Europe, then it's a good thing, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, no question.
Because your goods and services are much have you get more for their money, so it's good for business.
That's right.
And you guys point out that this might be good timing for this with our economy sort of being a little sluggish right now.
Well, that's right. We really need some other, I guess, charge into the economy with some of the other indicators lagging a bit.
Like housing.
Right.
We've had a little bit of a real estate slump, especially housing.
Right, and we've got the problem with high gas prices slowing things down.
We have all that. And Joan, how many times, how many years now have you and I been saying, when are the Europeans going to get off their backsides and start helping out the world economy?
About 100.
They've been a drag on the U.S. On the world economy now for more than a decade. When it seems that maybe they're picking things are picking up a little bit, right?
Finally, because for a long time we talked about how the U.S. seemed to be carrying just about everybody else, and how long could we be expected to do that?
And so the good news is, and it's interesting the way this cycle works, Joan. The good news is that as our economy is slowing, the European economy seems to be picking up, and you guys point out that for a first time in a long time, maybe ever, the European economy may actually outpace the U.S. economy.
Right, which I still have trouble believing that, even though I guess it's true. But
well, I'm in denial about
that
myself,
me too,
Joan. But you know the thing is the reason that's good news is because the economy doing better in Europe is going to create more consumer demand.
Right.
And they still like American goods.
Oh,
and so with our dollar being weak, and the growth in the economy in Europe, that's good for our exporters, and it's good for the balance of trade, isn't it, Joe?
No question.
So now we've turned our now, folks, what we've done we've taken the negative of the weak dollar, and we've applied the Pollyanna effect to it, right, Joe?
No, I disagree. It really isn't Pollyanna. There really are good things to a weak dollar.
Well, there are, and so we're going to talk a little bit more about this when we come back. There is a new trade deficit forecast out by Kiplinger that you'll want to pay attention to, and we'll talk about that and other issues when we come back right after these messages. It's 20 after. I'm Jim Blassingame. Stay with us.
She was a bebop baby. Your troubles make you cry. Don't waste a moment wondering why.
We're back. It's 23 after the hour. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and we're visiting with our good friend Joan Pride, senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. And by the way, Joan, while we were away, my crack team here has reported that the euro today is at 1.34 against the dollar.
Boy, that's a great crack team you have.
How about that? And there's more.
There's more.
There's more. Yes, they're telling me that there was a recent study on tourism, and it turns out that the very best tourists for America are the Japanese.
Really? Well, that doesn't surprise me, really.
Because they're polite and they don't trash the rooms.
Ah, see.
Guess who the second best tourists are? I mean, and this is not just to the United States. This is anywhere. Guess who the second best tourists are?
Not Americans, I'm guessing.
Why would you say that?
I don't know. I think we trash hotel rooms.
You do. Well, now, Joan, I'm not talking. You know, you're the exception, Joan. I know you're kind of a troublemaker, but I mean, everybody knows what a prima donna rock star you think you are, Joan. So,
right.
So I know that you do that. But you do have that reputation. No, the second place was Americans. And guess who was in last place, Joan? Just take a guess.
British?
No.
Russian.
This is so perfect, Joan.
What? Oh, French.
The French. The French.
Yeah, that must have thrilled you.
But you know, Joan, I'm, and we're getting off of the currency thing here. But while we're talking about the French, I'm so proud of the French. They elected a conservative, a president.
Yes, they did. He looks a little scary to me.
But he doesn't have a French name.
Sarkozy.
Sarkozy, yeah. He sounds like
Polish
a Russian.
Yeah. Sarkozy.
I don't care what his name is. I'm anxious to see what he gets done. But anyway, let's get back to the currency thing. You guys point out that an ongoing dollar weakness does pose long-term risks. At some point in time, interest rates will start rising as foreign investors demand higher returns. So far, I guess what you're saying, Joan, is the dollar, even as weak as it is still in demand.
Right, exactly.
But eventually it may not be. And so we do have that potential challenge. But if you're an export, the good news, Joan, is the more we can export and the more we can improve the trade deficit, the better off we are. And if it takes a weak dollar to do that, then maybe the weak dollar is a good fundamental right now. And Joan, you guys point out one in your economic forecast, one of the new things that you point out is the trade deficit is going down. Tell us about that.
Right, we're saying the trade deficit is going to narrow to $761 billion. Gee, is that all? but I guess to put it in perspective, I guess the more important statistic is that it would go down to 5.6% of GDP.
Right. And so that's good news, and the deficit's coming down. So we got some pretty good indicators. It's just very interesting. I think, Joan, if we could get this oil situation, the gasoline price fixed somehow, which I don't understand, Joan, can you explain to me why gas is $65 a barrel? And, I mean, the oil is $65 a barrel, and gas is at a record high right now.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because I had a long talk with actually one of the other folks that from Kiplinger that has appeared on the show, Jim Ostroff.
Oh, yeah, Jim.
And I said, Jim, how is this possible? Is it really the refinery problem? He said, well, there have been some refinery problems. In other words, some refineries have had to go offline for repairs and things like that, and we're not building new refineries. But he said it's not as big a problem as the gas prices would indicate. His impression is that this is a market-driven, fear about refineries that haven't, and that there, so the refinery problems haven't completely manifested themselves. It's market fear, and he didn't use this word, but I think I'd use the word speculation as well, and that's why I'm paying $3.20 at the pump.
Well, and as you know, Joan, speculation is what has held the petroleum prices high in the past. And in fact, Steve Forbes and others on this show have said that that maybe as much as 25% of the price of oil in the past, at least, and probably now as well, is because of speculation.
Right.
In fact, if you remember when the Iranians took those hostages, oil spiked just on that one event. So I don't know about it just seems unseemly. And I have to say, Joan, I mean, I'm a capitalist, and I want to see companies be successful. But I have to say, it does appear to be, it is curious to me that when we have record high gasoline prices, and people say it's because of the supply and demand and all that, but then coincidentally with all that, the oil companies have record profits at the same time.
Yes, that really bothers me.
It makes me want to go, huh?
Yeah, right.
And I wonder about it. Now, interestingly enough, and this also troubles me, Joan, Congress is looking into this. And I don't know, I worry that we may be, you got to be careful what you ask for.
Mm-hmm.
Because as much as I'd like to know a little bit more about why gas prices are so high, when oil prices are not that high, it bothers me to turn the government loose on the marketplace. That's a scary thought to me. We got a lot more of this coming back up right after these messages with our good friend Joan Pride, senior editor with the Kiplinger Editor. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Doctor, Mr. MD, doctor. Now can you tell me what is... to a man who didn't let being named one of the 100 most important radio talk show hosts in America go to his head.
Woo! Woo! Yes! In your face!
He's Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate.
We're back. It's 34 after. Thank you very much for hanging around with me. My website is www.smallbusinessadvocate.com. And we have a new one, folks, that I hope you'll check out as soon as you can. I think you'll like it. It's called AskJim.biz, AskJim.biz, and it's a knowledge base. It's where you can go and get small business answers now. And I hope you check it out and use it to your advantage. We built it for you. There's no barrier to entry in the, for either one of our two sites. And if you can get there, we'll let you in. And, of course, that includes the blog. I guess when you think of our blog, we actually have three sites. Even though the blog launches off of the homepage of smallbusinessadvocate.com, you actually can go to jimsblog.biz and find it there. So check out all the things there. We've got a lot of information, a lot of things that will help you. And by the way, if you hear something on the show that you want to hear again, you want to go back and pick up a website or a tip or hear something. I know you might not want to hear me again, but you might want to hear our guests again. You can do that by going to the smallbusinessadvocate.com website and find the name of the person who was on there, find the day they were on. If it was yesterday, you can go to that in the schedule page and the blog. You can find it all there, all the shows and the archives. And you can stream it, you can download it, you can podcast it, whatever you want to do. We make that available to you, so you're welcome. Check it out when you get a chance. Joan Pride is our guest, and Joan, we're talking about the most recent Kiplinger letter, and we're over to, I think we're ready to talk about regulations that are some new things for smaller privately held firms, at least privately, maybe not so small. Can you help us understand what's going on here?
In terms of the regulations.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, privately held firms, you know, there are new accounting rules that are called generally accepted accounting principles that I don't pretend to understand real well.
Right. But, well, the gap is exactly that, generally accepted accounting principles. And these are rules that companies have to abide by.
Right, exactly. And even though private companies aren't required to follow GAAP, most of them do because, and this is the same thing, you know, you have the same problem with Sarbanes-Oxley. Sarbanes-Oxley doesn't apply to private firms, but a lot of them need to follow it because they're, you know, bankers, investors, customers, and insurance companies, others look to them to see what their standards are.
Well, and this is all part of the, when you're talking about private and public, public meaning publicly traded.
Right.
The GAAP rules were designed so that people who invest in companies, you know, in a range of companies, can feel like that those companies are all reporting off of the same kind of rules.
Right. Well, right. And these in particular are called the consolidated reporting rules, which, as I understand it, don't really mean anything for private companies. It's stupid to have them follow the consolidated reporting rules since they're really only important for publicly traded firms. So they're going to get a pass on having to follow those rules.
Because it costs extra money. It costs a lot extra to do that.
Right, for very little benefit.
Especially since if the company's privately held, it's not the kind of disclosure information that's required to, you know, when a company's publicly held, then, you know, they're trying to protect grandma and you know, the average investor from getting bad information. Well, if it's privately held, the privately held companies don't have to do that. They don't have to report that kind of information.
Exactly.
Only to their shareholders. So this is good news. They're saying that they're gonna not require some of the GAAP rules for privately held companies, right?
Right. The consolidated reporting rules, right.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're talking about.
Anything else on that?
Well, we do say that there's going to be new fair market valuation standards, and that these are used in when you have a merger or acquisition, and that helps you see whether a firm's assets are very liquid. So even though these companies aren't public, they still might be acquiring other companies or involved in mergers, so you would still want that information.
Well, and see, Joan, there is another issue here, is if your company is getting to the point where it could be acquired, or if it's getting to the point where it could be moving towards going public, you've got to start conforming to the rules that the companies who might acquire you are going to require of you.
Well, that's a good point. Yeah.
And are they, if you're going, and so you have to sort of, it's a transition thing that you have to do, and it depends on what your exit strategy is. It depends on what your goals are.
Right.
And Joan, you were talking also about private companies being impacted by GAAP, even though they don't have to comply with it. And Sarbanes-Oxley, the new regulations, even though private firms don't have to comply with Sarbanes-Oxley, it does impact private companies.
Exactly, right.
Because, for one thing, the higher cost of audits these days and the competition for, you know, auditing firms has increased the cost of accounting for and auditing for private companies. So it's when they pass Sarbanes-Oxley, it hurt everybody. Ponytail, stay with us. We're back. It's 17 till. Little Steely Dan for you there. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and we're having a great visit with our good friend Joan Pride, senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. And folks, I like telling you about their website, which is Kiplinger.com. And it's a place where you can go and get some pretty good information on what's going on in the world of business and finance. And there's a lot of free stuff there, but if you want to get a lot more stuff, you can subscribe to their publications, and they'll let you get into the back of the website there, where they got a lot of good stuff. A lot of extra good stuff, and that includes the Kiplinger letter, which is the flagship weekly letter that's been coming out now since 1923, and that's the one Joan and I work off of every week. And then they also have three biweekly letters: the California letter, the tax letter, the agriculture letter. Those three every other week, and then there's a monthly magazine that Joan's going to tell you about.
You bet. It's called Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine.
And how about a phone number?
Oh, right. Our toll-free number is 800-544-0155.
And, folks, I worked really hard to get you guys a 30-day free trial. So is it 30 days or 90 days now?
No, it hasn't changed. Still 30
That's right.
Days.
I'm working on the 90-day free trial,
you,
folks.
You keep working on that.
I haven't gotten that one done yet, but right now it's the 30-day free trial. So check it out when you get a chance. Joan, 35 years ago, there was a guy named George Wallace who decided to run for president as an independent.
Yes.
And until he was basically shot, assassinated, he wasn't killed, but
yes,
until he was shot by, I've forgotten the guy's name who did it, he was actually kind of mucking things up pretty good. And I'm not sure he didn't have a chance to win until he was taken down.
And if I remember correctly, Richard Nixon was pretty worried about him.
He was. Well, I think the Democrats were too. And so about 20 years later, another interloper showed up in the form of Ross Perot. And many, including Bush 41, believes he cost him his second term.
It was that giant sucking sound.
That giant sucking sound. And then about 7 or 8 years ago, another guy shows up, and many believe, including Al Gore, that this guy cost Al Gore the presidency.
Mr. Ralph Nader.
Yeah, and I think it's hard to deny, Joan, that had Nader not been an independent candidate, that Gore would have won. May have won Florida, which would have changed history.
Oh, right. I think you're right. I think Nader made a huge difference. And he didn't really get that many votes, but he did enough to do a lot of damage.
Now comes another potential independent candidate. Tell us about this.
Well, this is Michael Bloomberg. He's the mayor of New York City, and he is a Republican. He's a very, very
liberal. Rhino.
Right, he's a
tell him what a rhino
is. Name only, right.
That's right.
He ran as a Republican, I believe, because there's just too many Democrats in New York, and he won. And he's mayor of New York, but like I said, he's a very, very liberal Republican, and there's some talk that he might run for president as an independent.
So clearly he has no party, no loyalty to any party, apparently. He has more loyalty to Michael Bloomberg, and... So what do you think, Joan? What do you think about all this?
Well, I just don't know how well known he is outside of New York City. I only know him pretty, I don't know him personally, but I've known of him for years just because he started Bloomberg News, which has kind of taken the newswire world by storm and become the giant killer, become a giant itself. And his pockets are unbelievably deep, so he would have plenty of money to run a presidential campaign, much like Ross Perot.
Well, according to Kiplinger, and folks, this is in a shaded block, so this means Kiplinger thinks it's important. Bloomberg is, I'm reading this, folks, right off the letter here. Bloomberg is a good bet to appear on ballots in all 50 states, spending $1 billion, folks, with a B, $1 billion of his own money to cover campaign and ad costs. Now, Joan, that kind of coverage, that kind of a war chest may not win him an election, but is no question that kind of activity would influence the election.
He sure could be more than an asterisk in that situation. Yeah, definitely.
But now, Joan, it was fairly clear that Ross Perot was going to be the threat to George Bush. It was fairly clear that Nader was going to be the Nader for the threat to Al Gore. Who is Bloomberg going to be the threat to?
Well, the even better question is, listen to this. Let's say you could theoretically have a general election campaign in which all three candidates, the independent included, are from New York. Clinton, Giuliani, and Bloomberg.
Wow.
That would be very bizarre.
That would be very bizarre. And
it's not outside of the realm of possibility.
You're exactly right. And, wow. Think about that. I hadn't thought about that, Joan.
Sorry, I didn't mean to blow your mind there.
That does. As somebody who lives in flyover America, that's a scary thought. At least they wouldn't get together and one of them become a vice president.
Well,
I don't think that's ever going to happen. That would talk about bizarro world.
Yeah,
that would be
right.
Bizarro world. So what do you think, Joan? I mean, but I don't know. Wait a minute. I don't think that's a better question than my question.
Well, I like my question.
My question is, yeah, but you didn't answer my question.
I forgot what your question was.
I don't think Bloomberg could win, but I think he could have an impact. Who would he impact? Would he impact the Democrats or the Republicans more?
Boy, well, if he is, in fact, a rhino, a Republican in name only, does he then impact the Democrats? I don't know.
See, that's the point. You know, he's a liberal, so that's typically you think of Democrats. But he's now a Republican, so there you got that covered. I'm telling you, that's the better question. It's even better than yours, Joan.
No, I disagree.
Stand by. We got a little bit more to come right after these messages. Joan Pride and I will hash this out off the air and give you our decision right after these messages. Stay with us. We're back. It's 7 till. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and Joan Pride is our guest. She's senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. And Joan, folks, while we were away, Joan and I decided this is what we came up with. This may be the most interesting, the most bizarre election in anyone's memory. Joan, did we basically agree on that?
Boy, we sure did, yeah.
And we finally agreed on something, folks. That's a red letter day.
That's the bizarre part.
Yes, that's pretty bizarre right there. But
right.
But seriously, I mean, think about it. We got the two strongest Republican candidates, probably, are probably the two most nominatable Republicans aren't even officially running yet.
That's right, and that would be Newt Gingrich and former Senator Fred Thompson.
Yeah, and aren't these guys playing it perfectly? Don't you think they're playing it perfectly? Sort of being coy and dancing around the, you know,
sure, because they let the announced candidates beat each other up first.
Yeah, and spend their money.
Right.
But there's this aura about them, and it's very interesting.
Let me ask you, Jim, does there come a point where their failure to have already developed a fundraising infrastructure, does that hurt them at some point?
Well,
and they can't wait forever to jump in.
It can. For example, I know that one of the guys, who was it, McCain maybe, who'd already gotten, as you know, Thompson's from Tennessee. I think it was McCain, had already gotten a significant Tennessee investor to support him. And the guy would have gone with Thompson had he asked him, but since he hasn't, the guy said no. I said I'd go with whoever that other guy was, McCain, let's say. I said I would go with him, so I'm going to go with him. So yeah, it's a potential. I think they're all racing against a certain date, and I suspect that date is probably the next couple of months or so.
Yeah.
Where anything beyond that, then they start losing strength.
Right.
But it's going to be a very interesting one. Joan, talk to us about typo squatters. What's a typo squatter?
Well, a typo squatter is they register a domain name that may not be your domain name, but maybe just slightly off, in the hopes that someone will mistype your domain name and go to their site.
Whenever I say your website, I always say Kiplinger.com, even though when people say Kiplinger, they don't always say the G.
Right.
So maybe somebody would do Kiplinger without the G, and that would be you would think that was the name, and you'd go to their website instead of yours.
Or maybe your website is .net and someone types in .com by accident.
Yeah.
That's a common mistake. But so the thing to remember in all of this is it's a good idea to register names that are similar to yours. And that way you can avoid these typo squatters.
Well, exactly. And of course, sometimes it's not typo squatters. Sometimes it's just a common mistake. For example, I have a friend whose name has a funny letter in it. And I said, no one will know that. You better get your correct spelling of your name, because that's her website, is her name.com.
Right.
I said, get the correct spelling, but then get the variation of it.
Right. Yeah, like let's say you could have someone named Karen spelled with an I instead of an E.
Or
that's
a C,
a perfect example.
Or a K or whatever. Karen with a C or whatever. Yeah,
or someone whose last name was Pride spelled with a Y instead of an I.
Who would do that?
Yeah, I don't know.
What kind of wacko would
do that? A crazy Scotsman from about three centuries ago.
I guess so.
Yeah.
But yeah, you'd want the I and the Y. So, but the problem for little companies is not so much that somebody would be squatting on your name. They just might have it, or you just need to make sure you get it. But when you get into larger companies like Kiplinger, for example, then there are people who would try to steal your traffic.
Right, and try to hold that name hostage. So if you wanted to buy it back from them, they charge you an exorbitant fee.
Happens all the time.
You don't want that, right? Oh,
and,
it sure does.
Yeah, exactly. Joan, we got 45 seconds. Anything happening on immigration?
Gee, you're giving me there's a 700-page immigration bill pending, and you're telling me to wrap it up.
We'll talk about it more next week. What's the story?
Well, big compromise up on the Hill between the president and Democrats and at least some Republicans that would allow a guest worker program, folks to come into the country and work and then have to leave. It would also give illegal immigrants in this country a path to citizenship, and it would or at least permanent residency, and it would also tighten border security.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of criticism of the bill, and we could spend all day talking about the pros and the cons.
And we'll talk about it, I'm sure, next week. And by the way, it looks like the Democrats gave the president his money for Iraq without the timeline, right?
That's right. Yes,
but
they
it probably
did.
Will have the minimum wage, small business owners, so gird your
looks
loins.
That way.
That's coming. Thanks, Joan, for being here. Good job today.
Thank you, Jim.
We'll see you next time. Got to go for this hour. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, reminding you, never let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blassingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.